This is MSO News Sports. I'm Bill Newell, and we are joined by Steve Bolpette. Many of you know him from his many years as coverage of the Celtics and the NBA on the Boston Herald, now working, still covering NBA stuff, and we'll get to that in just a moment with Steve. But Steve, first up, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good to speak with you, Bill.
Steve, we came in contact a few weeks ago. You were a big part of the Frank DeFelice Diamond dedication over in Swampscott, former Swampscott baseball coach Frank DeFelice. You were telling me a moment ago, grew up in West Lynn, Greek family, but also went to school in Swampscott and so on. So many ties to both communities and, of course, to Coach DeFelice and his tenure in the Swampscott Public Schools and so on. So I guess, Steve, let's start right there with that. And we have a photo down below with you speaking at that dedication ceremony a couple of weeks ago. Tell us about your connection with Frank and what all led to this this event a few weeks ago that you were a big part of in spearheading.
Well, I knew Frank from when I was a really young kid, like maybe 6, 7 years old. And he was at BC, and my father worked for Harold Zimmern, and part of the job was working on concessions sometimes. And Frank would be there at McHugh Forum parking cars. So I knew he was a friend from back then. And then, you know, when I got to Swampscott, and he was a gym teacher and coach and all those things. And, you know, if you were any kind of athlete at all in Swampscott, he coached you during that time. And my high school years, he was at Zverian, so I think I try not to take it personally that when I got to be high school age, he left town. But years later, my best friend and I would be going to Swampscott baseball games to watch his nephew play. And I'd see Frank there all the time, and, you know, it just kind of struck me that, you know, Coach was continuing to support the program and continuing to be there for the players, for the coaches, to offer whatever help he could. And it just struck me that that's kind of the essence of community, you know, what we're taught to believe in. And he was kind of the embodiment of that. So the field, the diamond itself, had no name, and I just started pushing for it like about 4 or 5 years ago, and kept it going. And fortunately, we got the connections tied off, and it came through.
Yeah, and that day itself, Steve, what a great event. We did a post on it. We had the audio of it, but and some photos. But it turned out to be just a great event, and I'm sure met your expectations for what you could have hoped for on a day like that. In April, right?
Yeah, surpassed my expectations. I mean, the work that Paul Holleran and Joe Caponegro did, getting everything coordinated, was, you know, I think it was fantastic for Coach. And I think the people who came there and got to reunite and rekindle some old friendships, I think that was great too. So all around. And then, you know, the young people that were there that got to understand about the story of Coach DeFelice and the importance of, you know, his role in community and in sticking with it, I thought was really good. On it all worked on so many different levels, I think.
Yeah, Frank was one of those guys. I mean, he was a baseball guy. He coached football as well, but he was a people person, and, you know, he really loved people, I think, and you know, was you know, very much involved with athletics and the entire Swampscott community for sure.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah.
Steve, the other thing I want to just have you – oh, here's – you mentioned the McHugh Forum. So if we have some younger listeners there, that's where Boston College used to play hockey before the Conti Forum was built. So, you know, Steve, some of us older guys will remember that, but maybe not everyone for sure.
Yeah, as I mentioned that day, I think I told that story, and I said if you recall the McHugh Forum – be sure to schedule your colonoscopy. Yeah, it's, you know, I was a little kid, but I remember skating there. You know, it was a blast, you know.
No, absolutely. Or schedule your second or third colonoscopy, as it might be, I think. Yeah. All right. All right, Steve, I got to tell our listeners right now what you're involved with at this point. You're still very much involved with the NBA and in basketball. So give our listeners a little overview on that, and then we'll get into the series that opens up tonight.
Well, basically, I got hired by Heavy.com. It's a large website with, you know, news, sports, entertainment. But they wanted to do more original content. And basically, they wanted to take advantage of all the connections I've made over the years, the contacts. And my job is to find stories that aren't the basic stuff that everyone has out of press conferences and things like that. So it's been a great situation working with some really great people, with one of whom is another Lynn guy, Sean Devaney, who went on to work at Sporting News. He was their NBA writer. And so, getting to work with some really good people. And again, just kind of keeping up with the contacts from over the years has been what I'm up to. When I go to games, I'm there to talk to talk to players and coaches and scouts and referees and just kind of keep that going and find stuff out, basically.
I read there was a story about you speaking to some students a number of years ago now, I think, but you mentioned, I want to say you mentioned the legwork, you mentioned the phone calls, the contacts, and that is what reporting was all about years ago. I'm not sure how it is today. I'm sure that great reporters continue to do that, but tell our listeners more about that. What does that entail? I mean, being a beat reporter or the NBA writer or doing what you're doing now, it requires lots of contacts. That's the name of the game, as you were just telling us.
Yeah, I mean, it's, when I go back to my college and speak to students, it's like, tell me something I don't know. Everyone kind of wants to be a pundit these days, which is cool, but, tell me something I don't know. Talk to people. When I was working locally at Salem News and stuff, you get to know everybody involved. I mean, how it kind of comes full circle, or at least the circle turns, I covered a lot of Salem State stuff. And at the Coach DeFelice ceremony, Billy O'Neill, the legendary Salem State hockey coach, came up, and I hadn't seen him in years, and it was just great to see him. And, those are the kind of things that, but as a reporter, you really want to, build up contacts, get out, do the legwork. If you get to be a columnist or you get to be a sports radio host, they want you to give your opinion. That's part of why you're being paid, is to give your opinion. But I always tell, my students, like, you owe it to your readers, you owe it to your listeners, that your opinions be based on a true story. So, get out and talk to a whole bunch of people. And, it's pretty simple. It's pretty straightforward, I think.
Well, you mentioned Billy O'Neill and Salem State. I began at WESX so many years ago. Tom Thibodeau, now coach of the Knicks, was at Salem State as a basketball coach. And I was doing games on WESX, and Bob McKenna, the legendary St. John's prep coach, was doing color with me, and he was telling, Salem has this young eighth grader, seventh or eighth grader, I forgot what he was telling me about at the time, that this Rick Brunson, he's unbelievable. He's going to really impact the Northeastern Conference in Salem basketball. And, of course, now his son is playing for the New York Knicks, and Rick was in town, I guess, not that long ago. He was there for the 1990, I guess, Salem State Championship reunion team and so on. But it's amazing what, this little Salem connection with the New York Knicks. So I guess that's going to lead me, I wasn't going to mention that, but until you mentioned the Bill O'Neill thing. But what's your take on this Pacer-Knicks series, as we'll lead into the Celtics as well? That's just an incredible letdown for our kind of Salem-based New York Knicks team.
Well, yeah, I guess. Look, it was going to be tough on the Knicks. Rick Carlisle, the Pacers coach, former Celtic, he kind of knew what was up, and he knew that, that Tom's, his kind of a thing as a coach is he plays his guys a lot of minutes. And, you know, it's certainly worked out as well. I think he probably maxed out what the Knicks were capable of this year. But it's pretty clear that Rick Carlisle knew that if he had the Pacers extending defense, making the Knicks play full court, etc., that it was going to pay off. And I think we saw it as the series went along. It played more into Indiana's hands, and just the brilliance of a Jalen Brunson and guys like Josh Hart and Dante DiVincenzo and all those, you know, that's what kept this that's what made it a 7-game series even.
Right. Okay. I got you. Yeah. Well, how do you see now the Celtics are coming in hosting tonight, I guess heavily favored in the series. How do you see the Pacers Celtics Eastern Conference Championship Series shaken down?
Well, I mean, the Celtics' biggest problem usually is the Celtics. They've got to, you know, make sure they keep their wits about them and not fall into bad habits. You know, they know that they are the better team on paper. They know they should win this series. But, if you know, they have to be willing to go out and still do all the things that are required to execute that. And, you know, if they don't, and we've seen in the past where I think that they have been the better, more talented team and still haven't won, that this could be a more interesting series than I think the Celtics or its fan base, their fan base would like to see.
It seems too that with this Celtic team, and even with that Pacers Knicks series, what happened early really doesn't really change to the end of the game. In other words, if you start out fast and build up leads, you're going to win games. And, you know, the Celtics have, you know, when they've been in trouble, they've been in trouble early and so on. Games haven't necessarily been seemingly all that close. So, I mean, do we get a sense that how the Celtics start tonight is a major factor in how this game finishes?
Well, you know, they've given up some big leads over this past season as well. Look, the Celtics got knocked out of the playoffs in 2018, 19, 20. 21 was a little bit weird, but the finals in 22 and then last season against Miami in the conference finals, they got knocked out of those playoffs for one reason. When it came down to crunch time, the Celtics would play isolation ball. The ball would start sticking. It wouldn't move as much. And, you know, as I pointed out over the years, it's like, it's not that guys like Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown are being bad people about it. It's more like, hey, we're getting in trouble here. I've got to get the ball. I've got to go make a play, which is really, you know, it's nice that you want to take accountability, but you just took your team out of its offense. And if the Celtics move the ball, if they pass and cut and do those simple things, nothing crazy, nothing no highfalutin strategy here. If they just do the simple things, they're pretty much unguardable. But it requires, you know, sticking to that. And if you miss three or four shots in a row, you can't give up. You can't shrink defensively. You've got to maybe turn it up a notch defensively in those situations. So, you know, for all their talent, it comes down to doing simple stuff that you were taught, you know, in grade school, really, in CYO and in JVs and varsity and all along the line.
You know,
I should mention Goya, Greek Orthodox Youth Association basketball for my people.
Was the Aegeanus basketball tournament around back in your day, Steve? Was that?
Oh my gosh! Yeah, I think it started the year before I was born. yeah, I mean, you know, my father and my uncle are in the Harry Aegeanus Tournament Hall of Fame. That was the big thing on the calendar every year, basketball wise, when I was growing up.
Yeah, going back to the Celtics. Now, of course, you know, I don't watch as much basketball anywhere close to what you do, but it seems like, you know, I love watching the Jason Tatum games when he goes crazy and gets 40 points, but in the playoffs, they haven't needed that. And I think that's a good sign that that they don't have to win with a 40-point effort from him. What's your take on that?
I think it's depending on how the opponent's defense is set up, and usually it's set up to get in Jason Tatum's way. I think the fact that other people are stepping up, it's that says more about Jason Tatum. Not that he's not ceding control of the offense. If you're Tatum and they're going to double-team you or throw extra defense at you in different spots, you still got to play with force. But when that extra defender comes, that's when you have to burn the opponent with the right pass. So I think one of the dumbest things I hear, and it's national people as well, saying Jason Tatum's got to come out tonight and he's got to score 30, he's got to take over. It's like, no. He's got to make the play that's available to him, the best play that's available to him. If he's getting double-teamed, you know, that's been the problem for this team at the end of games, is that he tries to do that and live up to, you know, what that mentality is. And, no, you drive one-on-one and you're Jason Tatum, it's going to become one-on-two and one-on-three really fast. Look. Here's something that's basic. The Celtics, it's my favorite Celtic trivia question. The Celtics have never had a player lead the league in scoring, ever. Six guys who played for them have led the league in scoring for other teams, but they've never had a guy lead the league in scoring. And that says, you know, when people talk about the cliche of Celtic basketball, it's team basketball. So, yeah, if Jason Tatum has an impactful series, it doesn't necessarily mean he has to score a whole lot of points.
I totally agree with you on that. Here's my last question on this game or the series, because I don't want to hold you up too long. But it would be, as far as the Pacers are concerned, what would worry you most about this Pacer team? What's unique about them? What do they present to the Celtics the problem that they have to resolve, if you will?
Well, I think part of it depends on, but they should be able to, Celtics should be able to handle the Pacers even without Kristaps Porzingis. But there's a chance that I think the Pacers' size with Pascal Siakam and Miles Turner and Isaiah Jackson off the bench, he played really well in this last series. I think there's a chance that those guys could end up picking up some offensive rebounds and can do some damage there. It's going to require the Celtics. I think the keys probably to me are going to be Derek White and Drew Holiday defensively, how well they can pressure the ball and keep the Pacers from getting into their offense. Keep the ball from getting into a Siakam, and handle the, you know, the inside out stuff that leaves Miles Turner open for, you know, wide open for three pointers, which we saw particularly in that last game how he hurt the Knicks. So yeah, I mean, I think there are definitely challenges there, and those challenges could be even greater depending on how well the Pacers are able to exploit the absence of Kristaps Porzingis, at least for the start of the series.
All right. Yeah, good stuff. Hey, I want to just jump to one thing. So you began covering the NBA, covering the Celtics back when Larry Bird was playing for the Celts. So I bet this is a tired question that you must get so many times, but what can you share with us? A story about that team, those players, something you traveled with the team, all these things. What could you share with me about a story that we might not have heard or something that's shareable, if you will?
Huh. Well,
so I'm springing this one on Steve, by the way, but he'll.
A bunch of things over the years that kind of, you know, I mean, Larry's trash talk was hilarious. You know, the stuff he would say. I'll give you a couple stories. It was once in Richfield, Ohio, where the Celtics, where the Cavaliers used to play, and the fans were getting on Bird really badly, and he's coming over to the bench in a timeout, and he looks at this, you know, at the crowd, and they're yelling at him, and he says, you know, and because Larry he had a really good needle, He said, I could throw my wallet in the air and crush your whole section. So I thought that was interesting. But over the years, his competitiveness and how much he loved the game stands out. You know, the practices were fun. Back then, we used to just watch the entire practice. And, you know, but that whole team, I think we talked about how Jason Tatum needs to, you know, work with his teammates and not be so much a one-man show. Look at that team and how things interacted on the floor. Kevin McHale was, I still think, one of the two or three best power forwards that's ever played. But he had a little bit extra room to maneuver down low, because if he was on the same side as Larry Bird, the defender couldn't come down as quickly. And, you know, as a side to that, Bird had a little bit extra room to shoot because, you know, an extra defender couldn't come out for fear of leaving somebody else. So, you know, it's a community game, and when guys are on the same wavelength and they're playing for each other, stuff works.
Yeah. I tell people, too, the one thing that I tell people who I remember about that era is that you'd watch the 11 o'clock news for the highlights. You'd be at the game yourself. But every night after a Celtic game, they'd show the highlights, if you will, and there was always one Larry Bird pass. You know, it could be a basket, but it's usually a Larry Bird pass, and it was always creative, and it was like the hallmark of Larry Bird. And it was, did it change the game? Not necessarily, but it was just Larry Bird being Larry Bird.
Well, I do think that Larry and Magic Johnson did change the game, and in a way that helped coaches down to the youth level. Basketball, by its nature, there is a lot of individuality to it, but when you had Bird and Magic come into the game and all they were talking about was winning and getting better every year and making their teammates better, and they were both known for their passing, you know, I think that allowed coaches to get those points across. So I do think it changed the game. And, you know, the game's going to evolve over the years. It was becoming roller derby in the late 80s. With the Pistons and all that, the 3-point shot has opened things up a lot. It's let the game breathe. It's brought smaller players back into, you know, larger import. So yeah, you know, but those guys definitely changed things. And you know, they were selfish in their own way, but whenever they spoke and were public, they talked about, hey, we're here to win, and that became the big thing.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you. When I meant change the game, too, I was thinking of one particular game. You know, unless it's a 2-point game, then yeah, then it changed the game. But no, you're totally right about how they changed. They had a big impact on the game across the board and at all different levels of the game, for sure. You could not follow basketball and not be impacted by what Bird and Magic did to the game back in those years, so for sure.
But something you just pointed out in that question previously was something we goes back to what we talked about earlier. You know, people would check in at the 11 o'clock news to see the highlights. And as, you know, for young writers now, you know, you're covering games and you're writing stories about games that pretty much everyone has already seen what you're writing about. So you've got to find ways to tell them something they don't know. You've got to find ways to tell them something that they didn't necessarily see, which is, you know, getting a player aside and getting him to talk to you about critical points of the game. But, you know, if you've already watched the game, what are you looking for in the next day's paper? What's going to make you read a story about the game that you saw?
Yeah, no, you're right. I guess I really need to one last follow-up with you on that, because you would have been work and still are working, obviously, during this era when that changed. It used to be a game recap, if you will, when you first got into the business, I'm sure. But you're right. It's and I think about that a lot. And that's got to be the big challenge, right, to to find out what that what it is and what it is that works from night to night, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to the same thing of creating those relationships, those business relationships, where, you know, people will tell you stuff. You know, I mean, you know, getting, you know, Marcus Smart to, you know, kind of give you the head nod, let's talk in the hallway kind of thing, that's important to your job and for everybody. It's, you know, the game ends, the coach speaks at the podium, maybe a player or two speaks at the podium, maybe another player or two speaks with the crowd around them in the dressing room. Everybody has that stuff. What's going to make your stuff different? You know, not just who you can get to quote, but are you talking to scouts and assistant coaches from other teams that are telling you, hey, this is what we tried to do against this team, against the Celtics. This is what screwed up. This is, you know, how they beat it, or et cetera. You know, it's schmoozing is a big part of the job. And, you know, it can be difficult when, like when I was at the Herald and there were three different deadlines a night that you had to hit. It was a little crazy. And I mean, it was always amazing how stuff, you'd be writing a story from the West Coast and how quickly it would get from you sent back to the paper, printed and out on, into Chinatown or onto the trucks to move around to different spots. It's crazy. And now it's even more immediate with internet and with, you know, the immediacy. I can tell you one quick story that points out how crazy it is, or it got. Bunch of years ago, the Celtics had a guy named Brandon Bass, and one summer he was a free agent, and so, you know, we were working on that story all summer. One day during the off season, I was out working out, and my phone buzzes, and it's the GM from another team said, hey, look, I know you knew we were going after Bass. He's going to stay with the Celtics. He goes, I just talked to his agent. He's getting, I think the deal was like 3 years, $18 million or something like that. So this was a guy that I, you know, was a trusted source. So appreciate the call. Thanks for the call. Thanks for the heads up. End call, push Twitter, start putting up, you know, per source, Brandon Bass to remain with Celtics on free agent deal, and, you know, hit send. 15 minutes later, I'm moving from one spot to another in the gym, and the crawl at the bottom of the TV says, according to Boston Herald, Brandon Bass to remain with Celtics, and it's like, whoa. It points out that, you know, how fast you can be right and how fast you can be wrong. So you better make sure your, you know, your stuff is correct, and, you know, make sure you're comfortable with your sources and always check them out.
Yeah, I'm sure that, yeah, that's scary is what that is, isn't it? It's kind of scary and awesome at the same point, I think. All right. Yeah.
Well, I would tell people, well, students anyway, I said, if your mother tells you she loves you, get a second source.
Don't go with that. You're right. Yeah. All right. Steve, we love you. So thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
I'll have to check on that.
You might want to.
I've got to make some phone calls on that one.
You got it. But I really appreciate your insights. And thanks so much for joining us. Again, we'll put some links up here so people can follow some of the work that you're doing as well. But again, thanks so much for joining us.
No worries.
Steve Beaupet with us. Steve, hang on the line, and Wilkin, and this is MSONewsSports.com.